Previously on Breakdown.
Well, the way that I think she's looking at it is, if I can put a subpoena on him and force him to talk, who knows what I may learn. If Trump is the goal, she could have made it very simple, simply with the phone call. But I don't think it's just Trump. I think it's the whole Trump network, so to speak, the elections deal network. The only question is, will she bite off more than she can chew?
So that I can put what you want to share in context, because the politics of this aren't my domain. You have aired very publicly through your pleadings, and the district attorney has provided her perspective in pleadings about some of the back and forth and the tit for tat and the politics. That's not my space.
I think we're about 60% through of all of the people that we need to be brought up. I'm pleased with the pace that we're going. You know, there can't be any predictions. As you know, many people are unsuccessfully fighting our subpoenas. We will continue to fight to make sure that the grand jury and the public gets the truth. And I am very hopeful that by the end of this year, I'll be able to send the grand jury on their way.
Welcome back to Season 9 of Breakdown, the podcast from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution covering Georgia's most important cases. We are continuing our coverage of the special purpose grand jury investigation into what happened here after the 2020 presidential election. I'm Bill Rankin, the AJC's legal affairs reporter.
And I'm senior reporter Tamar Hallerman. Coming up, we take a look at the hotly contested presidential election 22 years ago, another time the courts had to get involved, and another time when the losing candidate had a tough decision to make. And we ponder the question, since District Attorney Fani Willis has issued subpoenas to former President Trump's chief of staff and inner circle of lawyers, will she try to get Trump himself to come testify in Atlanta? This is episode 11, Will Trump Be Invited? Of season 9 of Breakdown, The Trump Grand Jury, from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
The AJC's trusted veteran political voices, Greg Bluestein, Patricia Murphy, Tia Mitchell, and Bill Nigut, are the essential source for Georgia politics. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia. Sign up for the newsletter, download the podcast, subscribe to the AJC.
Al Gore won the presidential election in 2000, until he didn't. The networks all called the race in Florida for Gore not long after the polls closed. That would have put Gore over the top in the Electoral College. Until it didn't. After midnight, the networks began admitting they'd blown the call and declared that George W. Bush won Florida, and hence, the presidency. As NBC's Tom Brokaw said famously that night,
I think that it's fair to say, I think I indicated earlier, we don't just have egg in our face, we've got omelet all over our suits at this point, and on our face, and everywhere else. We awarded Florida erroneously at one point, came back, and managed to make everything equal by awarding it erroneously a second time.
Gore called Bush to concede the race. But at around 3 a.m., he called a stunned Bush back and retracted his concession. Because Bush's margin of victory was so small, it triggered an automatic machine recount. And with the stakes as high as ever, litigation ensued.
Four counties, at Gore's request, began hand recounts. And this introduced the nation to the phenomenon of hanging chads, incompletely punched paper ballots, and pregnant chads, paper ballots that were dimpled but not pierced during the voting process.
Bush filed suit to stop the hand recounts, and litigation intensified in both state and federal court.
One of the cases landed in my neighborhood, the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta. On the morning of the 9 a.m. arguments, I got to the courthouse shortly after 6 a.m. to make sure I'd get a seat. There were already about 20 to 30 people in line. I made it inside.
4 days later, on Saturday, December 9th, 2000, the appeals court issued its decision. It dealt Bush a setback, allowing the hand recounts to continue.
But just minutes later, really, just minutes later, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in ordered a stop to the counting. Gore supporters howled in protest. There was bitter acrimony.
The Supreme Court scheduled oral arguments just 2 days later, on December 11th. And the day after that, it reported the only votes that mattered. In the case of Bush versus Gore, the tally among the nine justices was 5 votes for Bush, 4 votes for Gore.
With the High Court's conservative justices in the majority and the liberals in dissent, the High Court ruled that, on equal protection grounds, the recount had to stop. And that was it. The final count had Gore losing to Bush by 537 votes out of almost 6 million cast.
And yet, you know, all liberals wanted to count it and all conservatives didn't want to count it. So something was, you know, clearly about partisan alignment there. And look, Al Gore had a very strong reason to believe that had all the votes of Floridians been properly registered, he would be the president. He would have won the state, and he would have therefore won the presidency.
That's presidential historian David Greenberg, a professor at Rutgers University, talking about that moment in time.
And at that point, I think it was, you know, a real question. Should he continue to fight? How could he continue to fight? And I think he understood that even though he might have an epistemological claim on the presidency, the facts might ultimately be on his side, the system wasn't.
The next day, December 13th, 2000, Gore appears on national television.
Good evening. Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time. Almost a century and a half ago, Senator Stephen Douglas told Abraham Lincoln, who had just defeated him for the presidency, "Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you." Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Let there be no doubt, while I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
Here's Professor Greenberg again.
I think Gore thought, you know, the more gracious thing, the more civic-minded thing, the better thing for democracy would be to fully and fairly concede and, you know, go privately nurse his wounds, but not prolong the sense of crisis any more than he already had or than the recount already had.
Greenberg compares what happened in 2000 to what happened after the 2020 election. He notes that after the Electoral College vote certifying Joe Biden as president, then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell acknowledged Biden as the rightful winner. And McConnell had previously said there had been legitimate legal routes to challenge state procedures.
But once those had all played out, it was over. And, you know, I think that's right. And the difference between someone like McConnell and someone like Donald Trump is Donald Trump goes through the red lights, goes through the stop signs and the barricades and, you know, just full speed ahead. And most of our politicians, you know, whether they're on your side or not, have the good sense to say, all right, this is a flashing red light. I really need to stop now. And Donald Trump just doesn't believe the traffic lights apply to him.
Here's Matt Pottinger, Trump's former deputy national security advisor, testifying in July before the House Select Committee.
This isn't the first time that we've had a close election in this country. And President Trump certainly had every right to challenge in court the results of these various elections. But once you've had due process under the law, you have to conform with the law, no matter how bitter the result. Once you've presented your evidence in court, judges have heard that evidence, judges have ruled. If you continue to contest an election, you're not just contesting an election anymore. You're actually challenging the Constitution itself. You are challenging the societal norms that allow us to remain unified.
and Pottinger turns to the decision made by Gore.
He strongly disagreed with the Supreme Court decision that lost his election bid and allowed President George W. Bush to take office. But he gave a speech of concession in late December, mid or late December of 2000, where he said, this is for the sake of the unity of us as a people and for the strength of our democracy. I also am going to concede. I'm going to support the new president. His speech is actually a pretty good model, I think, for any candidate for any office, up to and including the president, and from any party to read, particularly right now.
We revisit the Gore concession speech in light of recent developments. Here we are in September 2022. We're 22 years down the road from Bush versus Gore. It's been 22 months since the 2020 presidential election, but the graceful concession 22 years ago did not inspire the loser 22 months ago, and former President Trump continues to claim the election was stolen from him.
Here he is at a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, on September 3rd. He's there to support GOP candidates for U.S. Senate and governor.
What the FBI did was corruption and election interference on a scale that we have never seen before in our country.
The former president starts off referring to recent revelations about the FBI telling Facebook to be on the lookout for Russian propaganda and misinformation prior to the 2020 election. This led Facebook to restrict posts of a story about leaked emails from Hunter Biden's laptop that showed his business dealings in Ukraine.
According to pollsters, it made a 10 to 20 point difference, not even including all of the other totally determinative evidence of illegality that was found having to do with the 2020 presidential election scam, including ballot stuffing and not adhering to the laws, rules, and regulations of state legislatures, which is totally illegal. They just did whatever they wanted to do. And frankly, Republicans locally that ran things in a lot of states should be ashamed of themselves. Should be ashamed of themselves. The 2020 election was rigged and stolen, and now our country is being destroyed by people who got into office through cheating and through fraud.
Later, Trump zeroes in on the special purpose grand jury investigation.
If you look at Atlanta, I have a district attorney in Atlanta. She's after me for a perfect phone call. And yet, it's even worse proportionately than Chicago for killing. But the district attorney, Trump made a phone call because he was challenging the election. So they're after me for a perfect, by the way, perfect phone call. You'd be very proud of me. Just like the call to Ukraine was a perfect call. The one in Atlanta was a perfect call. Perfect call, and yet Atlanta is even worse than Chicago, proportionately.
The former president actually got his homicide numbers right this time. As of the beginning of this month, there had been one homicide in Chicago for every 6,000 residents. In Atlanta, it was one for every 4,300 residents.
So this leads us to the obvious question. Will Donald Trump himself get the opportunity to tell the special purpose grand jury why he thinks he made the perfect phone call to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger? Will District Attorney Fani Willis pull the trigger and have Trump served at Mar-a-Lago?
This isn't a small question, and legal experts are divided.
I think Willis should and probably will have to subpoena Trump to appear before the grand jury.
That's John Banzhaf, a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. After he heard the January 2nd phone call with Raffensperger, Banzhaf filed a formal complaint against Trump with the Fulton DA's office.
If she doesn't and doesn't indict him, there will be suspicion by many that she wimped out, that she chickened out, that she didn't pursue everybody as she promised to do. If she doesn't call him and does indict him, then he and his supporters will claim that he didn't get his chance to tell his story, that she presented a very one-sided position to the grand jury, that he was shut out, that he was denied due process, And I can almost imagine, I can almost write the speech that he would give about how very unfair it is that she didn't call him before the grand jury and allow him to speak. I think, considering that Trump is pretty clearly a target of the investigation, or certainly is at very least a person of very considerable interest, he's in the middle of everything. The heart of the investigation is his own phone call. He and many of his cronies, admitted cronies, have been called to testify. I think it's unthinkable that the guy in the very middle of this, and the guy whose phone call started it off, would not be called in an investigation. So she's got to do it. And by the way, if she does do it, I think the courts would almost certainly uphold her once the 2022 elections are over.
But Breakdown's longtime legal expert, Don Samuel, who's been critical of the Trump investigation, disagrees.
I'm not quite sure what the point of calling him to the grand jury is. He's presumably going to invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. I assume his lawyer would tell him you should not be sitting there answering questions. And he's already invoked his Fifth Amendment rights in the New York investigation, the tax investigation up there, or the corporate investigation. So he's already blamed it all on the, you know, the corrupt prosecutors and the corrupt attorney general in New York and the corrupt Fulton County. So that's just what he's going to do again, whether he invokes the Fifth Amendment or not. He's not worried about his followers believing that invoking the Fifth Amendment means he's guilty, nor would they care, frankly.
Samuel said that just a few days before a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll was published. It found that 27% of Americans, including 61% of Republicans, said they still would want Trump to run in 2024, even if he was convicted of a crime. Samuel, who represents Georgia legislators in the grand jury probe who fought their subpoenas, also has this to say.
So the question is, why would the DA do it? And the cynical view would be that she's going to do it just so he can plead the Fifth Amendment, and the grand jurors can see that in court and draw an adverse inference, which is, you know, they're allowed to do but shouldn't do. So I think that's why the DA may do it, but it's not for a great purpose. You know, it's to just to influence a grand jury into thinking, well, if he pleads the Fifth, he must be guilty. That's a shame, because that's not the way the Fifth Amendment works.
Norm Eisen co-authored the Brookings Institution report on the Fulton investigation, and he grappled with the same question. Should Trump be called to testify when he was also special counsel for the House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment trial?
Having myself been a part of debate about whether or not to seek the testimony of President Trump, I can tell you it's not a simple decision. But in the end, I think the factors weigh in favor of at least of making the effort. First, I think that's a decision for her to make. Second, it's tough to preview that decision because we're not privy to all the evidence that she and the special grand jury have that shapes that kind of a decision. But all of that being said, I think it is likely that she will attempt to subpoena him. It's very tough when you're deciding whether or not to prosecute a former president, not to give him the opportunity to speak to the special grand jury. I know when we were doing impeachment, we wrestled with this issue, and we ultimately decided to invite then President Trump to testify, both because we wanted his evidence. We thought it was important, obviously very unique, but also out of a sense that it was the fair and right thing to do. Now, he refused. And I very much suspect that if she managed to get him into the special grand jury, he would likely do what he did in the civil deposition that the New York Attorney General finally secured after lengthy, protracted wrangling in and out of court. He took the Fifth Amendment, and he would do the same here.
Trump reportedly took the Fifth some 440 times in New York.
Despite that, Melissa Redman, a former Fulton County prosecutor, says there's a good reason why the Fulton DA's office might want to interview a likely target.
even if there's someone you're ultimately going to charge, you want to remove the argument that I had a perfectly reasonable explanation if you had just asked me for it.
Redmond now teaches at the University of Georgia Law School.
So you kind of can head that off by sending them a subpoena to testify before the grand jury. You know, if you don't have anything to hide, if you're being helpful to helping us find out what happened, come in and tell us what you know. And then if at that point they say, well, I feel like I can't tell you anything on the grounds that it may incriminate me, then, you know, that says a lot. That kind of gives you an idea of whether or not you're barking up the right tree.
Here again is Professor Banzaff.
If Trump is called, I'm certain his attorneys, even though he hasn't always gotten the very best attorneys, would counsel him to take the Fifth on virtually everything. But if he appears and takes the Fifth, it could still be to his disadvantage. First of all, he may go off script, and he may answer some questions and give the prosecutor some additional ammunition. If he does nothing more than states his name and then takes the Fifth, it would make him look bad, I think, in the eyes of many grand jurors, even though he obviously has a constitutionally protected right to do it, and anybody with any sense would do it. But here is the problem. When Trump appears at rallies, he controls it. He's in charge. He sets the stage. He says what he wants. He sets the cadence. He deals with whatever he wants, and he has the home crowd advantage. Everybody behind him is cheering him on. But if you are a grand juror in Fulton County and you see Mr. Trump squirming on the stand and taking the Fifth to even what seems to a grand juror to be innocuous questions not related to criminality at all, you're more likely to get an unfavorable impression of him.
This is Breakdown from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
I'm Ernie Suggs.
And I'm Ned Ravone. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Robert James is the former district attorney of neighboring DeKalb County. He oversaw a special purpose grand jury investigation that ultimately led to corruption charges. He says Fani Willis can try issuing a subpoena to Trump, but if so, good luck with that.
So obviously, if you can subpoena him, and if you can compel, you know, because you'd have to compel his appearance, right? They're going to send an army of lawyers opposing it. Like, he's not going to just say, sure, I'll show up, see what time Tuesday, you know. if you can get, you know, former President Trump in front of a grand jury, in front of a special grand jury to testify, then by all means, do so. But he's the former president of the United States, and there are all sorts of protections and barriers that you're going to have to push through to get him there. So it's easier said than done, you know. I don't expect his appearance in Fulton County. You know, stranger things have happened, but I would be surprised if he appeared in Fulton County. I think that it's going to be a tall order getting past executive privilege and whatever else his attorneys are going to, whatever other privileges attorneys are going to raise to keep him from testifying.
James makes an important point. Trump is no courtroom novice, and he's likely to fight any summons in any number of ways. Such a battle could take months to sort itself out. And it's a question that could very well end up at the Supreme Court.
But if Willis does manage to get Trump before the special grand jury, he'll be on his own.
But if he does, absolutely. I can't imagine that he would sit and essentially expose himself to hours of cross-examination because that's essentially what it's going to be, and not just by the appointed prosecutor in the room, but also cross-examination by the grand jurors. Because you have to, what you have to remember and understand, and a lot of folks in the general public don't know this, is that your lawyer isn't in there with you. it's not like a jury trial where your lawyer is saying objection. No, your lawyer's not in there with you. It's you and the grand jury. You know, your lawyer has no right to be present.
Eisen says there's at least one important factor Willis must consider before making the big decision.
She set herself a risk timetable of attempting to conclude this special grand jury before the end of the year. What effect would asking Trump to testify or subpoenaing him to testify have on that timetable if it turned into a extended court battle? Would she be able to proceed even though that side litigation were going on? I think she would, but it is a complicating factor. Another option is to, and one that avoids litigation, would be simply to say, come before the special grand jury, and that's something she'll have to think about as well. I don't believe he'll do it. If she decides to issue a subpoena and he fights it, she can simply say, in the interests of time, we're going to proceed with the case. I do think that's a little harder to do, but workable once you've issued a subpoena.
Professor Van Zaff sees no drawback to Willis in getting Trump to appear.
I think all the scenarios of what could happen if Trump is called, again, I think the courts would allow him to be called, no matter what happens there, it's to the great advantage of the prosecutor, and I can't see any advantage to Trump. So Willis has every advantage and no disadvantage, every upside, no downside to calling Trump. And if Trump is forced to appear, I see only disadvantages to no matter what he does and what he says, and no advantage to him, which is why a good prosecutor is going to call him.
So these legal experts pretty much all agree that Trump should invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination if he appears before the special purpose grand jury. We've already had attorneys representing three of the Trump campaign's lawyers file motions and issue statements saying that their clients were going to take the Fifth and not answer questions, and also invoke the attorney-client privilege.
It makes you wonder why prosecutors are going to all this trouble if they know they're not going to get the answers they're looking for.
Samuel explains the thinking behind the Fifth Amendment.
The Fifth Amendment can be invoked by a suspect based on a legitimate good faith, righteous fear that answers to questions will be erroneously linked together into a chain of circumstances that falsely implicates the defendant. And that's why the Fifth Amendment was enacted. The Fifth Amendment is designed to protect the integrity of a person who is a suspect, and not to force them to have to answer questions, and not to force them to say things which could be misinterpreted or which can be linked together by a prosecutor who decides to, you know, link together too many circumstances into a circumstantial case.
The Fifth Amendment also serves this purpose.
Obviously, there are people who are guilty who are not going to willingly come in and answer questions. Did you do it, right, on pain of being, you know, prosecuted for perjury? Or where were you on the night of July 17th? So, yes, the Fifth Amendment does protect people from having to become witnesses against themselves. You can't be compelled to become your own worst enemy by answering questions.
What's happening before the special grand jury in Fulton County wouldn't be happening before a federal grand jury.
And in fact, the federal government doesn't even allow the use of the Fifth Amendment, the compelled invocation of the Fifth Amendment in a grand jury. For that very reason, if the government doesn't have sufficient evidence to convict someone, the fact that the person pleads the Fifth should not be an ingredient of a contrary decision. The grand jury should never, ever indict someone because they pled the Fifth Amendment. That would be ludicrous if that was the result of invoking your constitutional rights that you get indicted. So it doesn't contribute at all to the evidence of someone's guilt. Listen, the Fifth Amendment was in the Magna Carta, you know, long before the United States Constitution. This is not some, you know, democratic invention or libertarian invention. It has been part of the fabric of criminal justice systems, you know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, the Fifth Amendment has. And it serves incredibly useful functions in protecting people, not only guilty people, but innocent people. Anybody who says the Fifth Amendment is just a vehicle for hiding the truth or hiding guilt needs to find another constitution to live under.
Samuel says he has concerns about having one witness after another appear before the grand jury and invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Georgia does not have the same policy as the Department of Justice. So in Georgia, it is permissible to subpoena a witness to the grand jury who you have every reason to believe is going to invoke the Fifth Amendment and make him invoke the Fifth Amendment. There's no judge there to tell the jury, don't draw an adverse inference. It's a constitutional right. The DA just does it, and you're left at the mercy of the grand jury whether they will draw an adverse inference from your invocation.
Some observers say the Fifth Amendment discussion is premature because the special purpose grand jury doesn't have the power to indict anyone. It is simply collecting information and making a recommendation to the DA on whether to press charges. Charges that would need to be approved by a separate grand jury.
Getting back to Trump, the thought of him actually coming to Atlanta to testify is pretty overwhelming. When Rudy Giuliani came down here last month, there was a media circus outside the courthouse.
It was no fun being in the middle of that scrum of reporters and all those cameras. It's like being caught in a wave. You have to keep moving or you go under. At one point, I got between Giuliani and his lawyer, Robert Costello. I wasn't trying to, I was just being pulled by the wave. Costello dropped an F-bomb on me. I can't even imagine what it would be like if Trump appears.
They'd probably shut down the streets around the courthouse. There'd be lots of Secret Service. You'd wonder how many of his supporters would show up to cheer him on and protest the proceedings. And would he go in through the garage entrance, out of sight of the crowd, instead of having to walk through the front door?
Professor Banzaff has these thoughts about the prospect of such a spectacle.
And knowing Trump, it would not be beyond the pale for him to say, yes, I'm going to be called in, I'm going to be there at 9:30 in the morning and get these huge crowds outside to see screaming crowds yelling and screaming and carrying on and supporting him and carrying signs and so on is the kind of thing I think he'd love. So I don't think he'd hide in any way. I don't think he wants to sneak in the back. It's not like it's a perp walk. It's not like you're going to see him walking in there covering his face like some of these guys do. He's going to walk in there proudly and raise his fist and encourage his followers.
Oh.
My.
God.
We will see.
In episode 10, we told you about how the probe had expanded to include an elections data breach in Coffee County, Georgia, some 200 miles southeast of Atlanta. We know this because of the out-of-state witness subpoena being served to Sidney Powell, a former Trump campaign attorney who was involved in the episode. Since then, we've seen the grand jury's interest in the breach deepen.
Tamar reported that the special grand jury subpoenaed the Atlanta data services firm Sullivan Strickler for evidence. It's seeking all documents between the company, Powell, and Lynn Wood, the libel attorney who filed unsuccessful lawsuits challenging Georgia's election results.
As we told you last week, four Sullivan Strickler technicians traveled to Coffee County on January 7, 2021, a day after Trump supporters ransacked the U.S. Capitol. They copied confidential data from voting equipment. The information was eventually shared with Trump allies and conspiracy theorists.
All of this information has come out as part of litigation in a separate election security lawsuit. Recently released security camera footage shows the Sullivan Strickler group being led into the county elections office by Kathy Latham, who was then the chairwoman of the Coffee County GOP. Coincidentally, Latham was also one of the 16 Republicans who cast phony Electoral College ballots for Donald Trump. And all 16 have been informed they're targets of the Fulton grand jury investigation and could face criminal charges.
Many legal experts we've spoken to think prosecutors are likely looking at this Coffee County episode through the lens of RICO, the anti-racketeering statute. Possible predicate acts, Norm Eisen tells us, are computer trespass and computer invasion of privacy. But the details, such as who gave the orders and provided access to voting machines, will really matter here.
Amanda Clark Palmer, Don Samuel's law partner, is representing Sullivan Strickler. She says the firm, quote, is not and has never been part of a pro-Trump team or any team whose goal is to undermine our democracy through lies and conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. Palmer says the firm is politically agnostic and does neutral technical work. Quote, at the time they engaged in that work, they were operating under the good faith belief that their client was authorized to access the voting machines and servers. The firm elected to cease any further new work on this matter after the January 7th time period. With the benefit of hindsight and knowing everything they know now, they would not take on any further work of this kind. She added, Sullivan Strickler has been told it is only a witness, not a target, and it is cooperating with law enforcement.
In another development, the DA's office lost its first legal battle over an out-of-state subpoena. It involves Dallas-based attorney and podcaster Jackie Pick. She testified at a state legislative hearing on December 3, 2020, and presented footage taken election night at Atlanta's State Farm Arena. It purported to show election workers producing suitcases of unlawful ballots to be counted in favor of Biden. The doctored video has repeatedly been debunked by state and federal authorities.
In a ruling on September 1st, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals dismissed Pick's subpoena as moot because it expired the day before on August 31st. A Dallas County judge had ordered Pick to go to Atlanta and testify, but her appeal to the state appeals court essentially ran out the clock.
Fulton prosecutors can try to serve another out-of-state subpoena on her again. After all, the Texas Appeals Court didn't rule on the merits of Pick's out-of-state subpoena challenge.
But in two separate opinions, five of the court's nine judges indicated that they do not believe an out-of-state subpoena from the special purpose grand jury is one a Texas resident has to honor. This has implications for attorney Sidney Powell, who was also served an out-of-state subpoena to come testify in Atlanta. She lives in Houston.
Before we leave you, we have one final tidbit to share. We haven't heard a whole lot so far from the three new members of Trump's legal team in Georgia. They were brought on only a few weeks ago, after all.
We're sure that'll change soon enough, especially as the grand jury gets closer and closer to the former president. But in the meantime, we have this number for you. 528,000. That's how much the Make America Great Again PAC has paid Trump attorneys Drew Findling, Jennifer Little, and Dwight Thomas so far, according to federal filings.
Findling was paid $100,000 for legal consulting in July, but we're assuming that's just a down payment. We'll see updated figures in October.
Thomas and Little, meanwhile, seem to have more of a history with Trump world. Thomas has been paid more than $118,000 for legal consulting, including on recounts, since last year, and Little also helped with recount work. She made $310,000 since 2021. Those numbers will only go up as this investigation chugs along.
Next, on Breakdown, we have our eyes on Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Will he be required to come testify before the special purpose grand jury? Of course, we'll be back soon. This has been quite a ride so far. As always, thanks so very much for listening.
You can follow our daily coverage on our website, ajc.com. And if you really want to support local journalism, particularly our journalism, please subscribe to the AJC. Be safe and take care. Until next time, I'm Bill Rankin.
And I'm Tamar Hallerman.
This is Breakdown from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.